So welcome back, everyone. It's 9 o'clock Thursday. Sorry. We will be kicking off this morning with risk policy, and I will turn it over to Chair Ware. Thank you.
Good morning. Thanks, Dan. The risk policy met last Friday, so we will be going through a presentation of the updates we have. We're still eyeing June as a vote by the council for an updated concept document. And we welcomed Gareth Lawson to the risk policy work group. We had an open SSC seat, so glad to get that filled and have Gareth on board. So I will pass it to Jonathan. I think we're going to tag team the presentation today.
Good morning, everyone. Jonathan Piros here on council staff. So we have a substantive update on the risk policy for you today. I think building on what you heard in the December meeting, I wanted to begin though by thanking the team at the University of Maine who has been evaluating and stress testing our risk policy in conjunction with their work on harvest control rules. A lot of what you're going to hear today is in direct response to some of the recommendations and input that they provided to the working group. So thank you to Lisa Kerr, Roger Brothers, and the rest of the team there. A lot of this builds on their very good work. No action required today, but I think any input from the council would be useful as the working group plans future meetings and works towards a June vote for changing the concept. So just a quick recap of where we've been since the council approved the new risk policy that became effective on January 1st, 2025. It's been used in two phases. So we have the current alpha phase, which is updating the risk policy matrix to reflect the factors that the council had identified. This is really a qualitative application that should look and feel a lot like the risk policy that folks would have used prior to the update. What we're going to talk about and focus on today is the beta phase, where we've been and where we're heading. So a lot of simulation testing, you heard about that yesterday, or a little bit about that yesterday from Dr. Kerr. The council went through a weightings exercise last April. We're working to incorporate a lot of the revisions that and recommendations that we've heard to revise the concept at this time. That's what we're working towards for the June meeting and thinking about the risk policy's connection to harvest control rules. So hopefully in the next few months, things will be coming together between the risk policy and harvest control rules, and we'll see that quantitative application that was initially envisioned in this work. So all of that comes together in five steps. So we're going in this slide where is a schematic of showing the risk policy concept in concert with harvest control rules. Factors get weighted and scored. And so the weightings process will apply for all stocks and all FMPs. Scoring is going to apply to the range of factors that the council identifies. We're going to have some updates on the number of factors that have been identified. But here we're thinking about the size of the stock, incoming recruitment, climate vulnerability, commercial and recreational fisheries. That's sort of where we've coalesced in the past month or so. That builds into the Z-score, which is going to say something about the council's level of risk tolerance, and hopefully that will plug into the harvest control rule. And by April, I think we want to show a soup-to-nuts example of how the risk policy would work with some of the harvest control rules that you heard about yesterday from Dr. Kerr. So what's the plan for getting there? The deliverable is going to be an updated risk policy concept document. The version that you approved in September of 2024 lives on the council website, so we'd be replacing that. As just a reminder, this is really the process and procedure of how the council applies the risk policy. So we have the risk policy statement, we have the goals of what it's trying to achieve, but then it really outlines how you go about using the risk policy, and that's where we need to make some updates. We've talked about June at a couple meetings now, so that would include an update to the concept document and a weightings exercise by the council. And I think we'll go through what that's going to look like between this meeting and the June council meeting. So this graphic, this slide, is really just intended to show the various meetings that we'll be discussing the risk policy over the next few months. So we have the update today. There'll be a check-in with the SSC and with the council in late March and early April, some further refinements, and then this will be in front of you again at the June meeting, again, focused on updating the concept and the weightings exercise. In the bottom part of the slide, we're just outlining some of the other work that we still think needs to happen. So Megan is going to talk a little bit about the risk policy mechanics. That includes the shape of the curve, the range of scores we use, how everything gets scaled. There's still, I think, a little more refinement that needs to happen there. And so there's a group of folks who are going to be involved from the risk policy working group, but also the University of Maine. And then we have kind of this internal staff team that's thinking about how are the plan teams going to do the scoring of each of the factors now that the working group has recommendations about what they should be. And so that's about accessing the data. That's about some data decisions, providing guidance to the plan teams. It's kind of the internal process that we're thinking about. And so some of my colleagues and Angelia Miller are involved in that. So to get at the kind of heart of the factor piece of this meeting, we can kind of think about it in two parts. We're going to talk about changes to the factors and then updates to the mechanics. Just as a reminder, there were three different groups of factors that the risk policy identified. So stock status and uncertainty, that included three factors, climate and ecosystem considerations, and economic and community importance. In this table, we have the seven factors listed. We have the high-level risk policy working group recommendation on whether or not we'll be using those in June 2026. And we're going to step through each of the factors over the next few minutes and talk about why we think things should be in, maybe why we should temporarily remove some of the factors and just catalog them for now. So kind of put it in the parking lot, and then we can certainly hear any feedback from the council. So we'll go through each of these in turn. So I'm going to start with biomass stock status, and this is really about the risk associated with the current productivity of the stock. So as the size of the population relative to a reference point increases, we think risk tolerance should increase. I think importantly, the how you score this factor, so how the size of the resource and the condition of the resource inform whether or not the council might have high or low risk tolerance, and that's shown in the table at the bottom of the slide. The plan is to use this in 2026 with really no changes to the scoring that was proposed back in late 2024 in the original concept. Moving on to recruitment. So this is about the risk associated with the future productivity of the stock. And so we think as recruitment increases, the council's risk tolerance around a decision might increase. The directionality of this is also two ways. So this factor can both increase and decrease risk tolerance. So if you have persistent low recruitment, you might have low risk tolerance. If you think about there being multiple large year classes within a recent time stanza, you might have higher risk tolerance. This is one where we are proposing some changes, really around how the factor is scored. So the focus still continues to be on the size of year class, recent year classes. But one of the things we learned from the UMaine work was that there were some difficulties in interpreting how the initial rubric was set up. So we need to answer questions about what is a large year class, how far above or below the mean would be considered large or small. And so I think that's kind of the flavor of some of the staff implementation work that we'll continue to do over the next few months. But these are reasons why we're recommending changing the scoring approach to address some ambiguity in that initial guidance. And again, as an example here, we've landed with this quantile-based approach to recruitment scoring. So before we were talking about recruitment simply as high, average, and low. Now we're thinking about recruitment, recent recruitment relative to the full time series of recruitment estimates. So thinking about the most recent 5 years, whether there's been below average, average, or above average recruitment, binned into three different quantiles. So moving on to assessment type and uncertainty, this is one of the factors that the working group is recommending to pause and catalog. We'd like to check back in sometime later this calendar year But this factor is about the risk associated with stock assessment performance and uncertainty. So as assessment uncertainty increased, we were thinking that risk tolerance would decrease. You would have lower risk tolerance associated with more uncertainty. The directionality here was, as initially conceived, just in one direction. So if you were at an analytical assessment with really no retrospective patterns, you might be a zero, kind of neutral in our factor scoring scale, and you could only move towards having lower risk tolerance. What we've stated is we want to, again, remove and catalog this. We think it needs continued refinement. The working group thinks this is a really important factor area to continue to develop, but not ready for prime time. And some of the reasons for that, for this was instability in stock assessment products that we're seeing. So when the working group initially developed this factor, we didn't know about data updates. We still kind of approached it with the frame of reference of ASAP models with various diagnostics that don't necessarily come through in the WAM model. And so at this point, I think we want to drop this assessment factor for the time being and to continue to develop the factor for future use. As I mentioned, stock assessments are a very important criteria. We'll continue to document this information in the revised risk table. So we're not thinking about changing the risk policy matrix in any way. It's really about whether or not this information is included in the Z-score that's used with the harvest control rule. So moving on to fish condition, and this is the other factor that the working group has recommended to pause and to catalog. This is about risk associated with ecosystem productivity, so fish condition being used as a proxy for that. So the idea is that as fish condition decreases, so this is a length-weight relationship, risk tolerance would decrease. For the directionality, this again was one way you could only decrease your risk tolerance or lower your risk tolerance in the initial conception of this. And so we felt like this area needed more work. And so we're recommending removing and cataloging. There's still, I think, a lot of support on the working group for including a factor that focuses on ecosystem characterization and risks related to changes in habitat, to changes in trophic relationships. This is a lot to try to capture in one thing. And so fish condition, I think ultimately we felt like needed a little bit more work. One of the other things that I think we've heard consistently from several bodies is the potential for correlation between fish condition and other factors like recruitment. And so planning to come back to this and maybe think about this more later in the calendar year. One of the other things I'll say is we kind of deliberated this. There were some ideas about different factors that could be used. So we talked about a forage index, productivity anomaly, so recruitment over SSB, some different ways that we might think about capturing this information and making sure we're characterizing ecosystem change. So in for 2026 is climate vulnerability. This has been pretty consistent over time. So this is about the risk associated with climate change. And so as climate vulnerability would increase, your risk tolerance would decrease. Again, when you think about the directionality of how this applies, this is one way it can only decrease your risk tolerance. We're recommending for use in 2026 with no change to the scoring that's proposed. This uses the Hare et al. Work from 2016 that looks at vulnerability scores and directional effect. I think we recognize that that information is becoming dated. We know there's ongoing work to update that, but the group was supportive of including climate vulnerability and felt like it was an important factor for use this year. So in the short term, we'll continue to use the Hare et al. Analysis. But the working group has talked about that it's becoming dated. There is a product coming out of the Northeast Center, so the Climate Vulnerability Assessment 2.0. That's a product that we hope will at least see a version of it in fall of 2026. I think we recognize that that product might require some changes to how we end up scoring this factor. So the output might look a little bit different than what we've landed on for scoring with Haridol. But we're confident that this will be a good product. It might include more information than we're currently looking at with this factor. And so we plan to revisit this again later this year. And I'm going to hand it over to Megan for the next set of slides.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about the commercial fishery factor. This is proposed as in for our June 2026 deadline. And here we're trying to understand the risk associated with the socioeconomic health of the commercial fishery. I can't remember the last time we showed this to the council. So I think something that's new is having this be a factor that adds risk tolerance. And so here we're trying to capture as socioeconomic stress or distress increases in a commercial fishery that tends to lead to comments about higher risk tolerance or liberalization. So trying to capture that, I think we felt a little weird that if there's strong socioeconomic health in a fishery, that that would lead to more precaution. So that's why this is a one-way or proposed as a one-way factor to add risk tolerance. Next slide. So there's been lots of iterations and feedback on the commercial fishery factor. I think it's been one of our most challenging factors to develop, but I also think we've acknowledged that it's really essential and critical to the risk policy. This is a defining feature of the risk policy. I think our conversations have been trying to keep it simple as best we can, especially with the June 2026 council vote, and trying to be clear on how each variable relates to risk tolerance. And I think a consistent theme we've heard is how are we able to incorporate or consider the most recent data, whether that's from the last fishing year or the current fishing year. That seems like a real opportunity for this risk policy. Next slide. So this is where we are at right now with the commercial fishery factor. It does not look simplified, but I do promise that this is a simplified version. So there are five elements of this factor looking at quota usage. So has greater than 80% of the quota been caught in at least two of the three last years? I think that would suggest that this is either a choke stock, a high abundance stock, or certainly a stock where if there was a quota reduction, we would feel socioeconomic impacts. We've had a lot of discussions about the importance of fishing communities and how to capture that. I think in this initial iteration, we're proposing looking at changes in primary and secondary ports. Value, so looking at changes in the revenue of the fishery and specifically for groundfish, where it's a multi-species fishery and we are lucky to have revenue information on each of those stocks. Looking at how the stock revenue contributes to the overall groundfish fishery, I think this will be important for capturing things like pollock or redfish, which historically have not been choke stocks, but are very important to the value of the groundfish fishery. Identifying constraining stocks. I think this has been a pretty common theme. So is quota for a species limiting the execution of other fisheries. And then a new element here is an AP question or an opportunity for AP input. Again, really trying to understand how do we get current fishing year information in this risk policy. And the AP is a way we could do that. Hopefully it builds buy-in with the AP. So trying to understand, you know, is the situation better, worse off, or consistent with how we've answered the questions above? And that could lead you to move a little bit to the right, stay where you are, or move a little to the left within this scoring. Next slide. On our call on Friday, we had some good feedback on this. So I've just put it on the screen here and tried to organize it in terms of things I think we can get to by June and things we cannot get to by June. So I think the things, you know, getting to by June are, you know, admittedly a little bit easier to tackle. There was a lot of discussion about lease markets. I just don't anticipate that that's something we're going to be able to conquer by June. Next slide. So next is our final factor, the recreational fishery factor. We are proposing to use this in 2026, very similar to the commercial factor in that we're trying to capture risk associated with socioeconomic stress of the recreational fishery. And like the commercial factor, this is something where socioeconomic stress, as that increases, our risk tolerance increases. So this is a one-way directional factor. Next slide. This is what we have so far for the recreational fishery factor. So asking questions about if recreational fleet diversity is decreasing, that's something that's reported in the State of the Ecosystem report. Are the number of angler trips in New England, which are not targeting striped bass or tuna, decreasing? Looking at the PSE for total catch and MRIP, is that consistently below 30? So is our uncertainty consistently in a lower tier? And also looking at consistency of regs, I think if we've had a lot of change, as maybe was demonstrated in the groundfish discussion yesterday, it can mean the catch projections for the next year have greater uncertainty. So trying to capture those elements within the recreational fishery factor. Next slide. Again, we had some feedback on the Friday call. I think everything we can try and address by June, but the one I'll call attention to is adding a wrap question. I think this allows, again, for that timely data, some buy-in from the recreational advisors, representation, and parity with the commercial fishery factor. So I see that as kind of the most striking change that I suspect we will make based on our call on Friday. Next slide. So this is where we've ended up, our five proposed factors, as well as how they either add risk tolerance or add more precaution. You'll see we have a bit of a range. Our two top factors can go both ways. We have our climate vulnerability factor, which only adds precaution, and then our commercial and recreational factors that can add risk tolerance. Next slide. So that is an overview of the factors. I'm gonna now go into some of the mechanics of the risk policy and discussions we've had on that and changes we're proposing. I apologize in advance. Some of this is a little mathy. I'm going to try and do my best to not be too mathy in my descriptions here. I'm going to focus on shape of the curve first and then scaling of z-scores second. Next slide. So right now we are using a logistic function, which is basically this curved line you see on the screen. And we've been cutting it off at 50% because we want at least a 50% probability of success to try and mirror some of the MSA requirements about overfishing. But there are consequences of using this, this portion of a logistic curve. So at very low z-scores, so I'll call folks' attention to the bottom left side of the graph where it says high risk tolerance. You can see that small changes in the z-score, so small movement on the x-axis, can make a lot of change on your y-axis. And the result of this practically would mean you can, like if you're talking about the distance between your OFL and your ABC, that distance can shorten up very quickly when you are willing to accept high risk tolerance. And conversely, when we're in a situation with a high z-score, so focused on the right-hand side of this graph, we're talking about a more precautionary state, but it takes a lot of movement on that x-axis to result in any change on the y-axis here, and hopefully that's shown by the arrows. We're just on a flatter portion of the curve there, and so it takes a lot of momentum or a really extreme situation to get us to a really precautionary state. Next slide. So we've talked a lot about, is that appropriate or should we consider different shapes? We've talked about, again, our current formation, a linear formation, an inverted logistic curve. And all of these have repercussions in terms of how quickly or slowly you move along the line based on your z-score. Next slide. Ultimately, we are recommending using a full logistic curve within the upper right quadrant of the graph here. So we're still holding ourselves to a 50% probability of success, but trying to squeeze that full logistic curve in there. And I think the result of this is our steepest part of the curve is now in our intermediate Z-scores. So you can move, you know, have some more significant movement, as an example, between your OFL and your ABC at those intermediate Z-scores, which I think is where we expect more species to end up. But it takes a little bit more effort or a more extreme example to get to our most precautionary state, and similarly to get to our most liberal state. So we think this is kind of more reflective of what we've talked about in terms of stability, where it would take a lot to get to the extreme ends of our line here. We have formed a subgroup to better evaluate the implications of this between now and June. So this is in conjunction with the UMaine team. So a big thanks to them for their help in the math elements of this risk policy. Next slide. And then the other mechanistic part here I'm going to talk about is the scaling of scores. So just to take a step back and remind folks, the risk policy here is we're using factors. We score them based on recent information. That's what the PDT does. And then the council weights them, and that's a level of importance of the factor to the council. We multiply those, sum them up, and that gives us our level of risk. And on the scoring, particularly in the slides we've shown so far today, you know, we have some scores that are -4 to 4 at their scores, or -4 to 0 or 4 to 0. But when we are in the Excel sheet and kind of doing the background math on this, we're actually scaling those scores down to a range of -1 to 1. And that has implications that I'll talk about on the next slide. So again, nothing is different in terms of what the council sees. We're still planning to score something from -4 to 4, but the scaling that we do can likely influence the full extent of the curve that we can achieve. So we've looked at what happens if we scale to 2 instead of 1, or what if we don't do any scaling and we keep everything -4 to 4? Does that mean we can access a greater portion of the curve? Next slide. And the answer is yes. This is some of the results from the simulation testing. When we are scaling down to 1, we're really only accessing a small portion of the curve. And as we increase our scaling, so to 2 or keep it at 4, we can access a larger portion of the curve. And hopefully that's the visual that folks are getting from the screen here, where the red dots are really clumped around the lower portion of the curve. And we kind of expand our range of the curve depending on the scaling. And I think the risk policy work group is interested in being able to access the full range of the curve. So there's no point in having high Z-scores or low Z-scores if you can't actually achieve those values within the risk policy. Next slide. So our recommendations have been that the scaling should be high enough to access a broad range of the recommended probabilities, so effectively using the full shape of the curve. And so we're planning to do some reevaluation of the scaling that we've been doing. This, again, does not impact kind of what it looks like on the surface. We're still planning to score things 0 to 4, but it impacts the background math that we do in the Excel sheet. I didn't want to throw an Excel sheet figure on here. I didn't think that would be a winning strategy for a Thursday morning risk policy presentation. But if anyone is interested in seeing the Excel sheet or the background math, please just reach out. I'm happy to share it. But if you're not interested in that, that is fine as well. Next slide. All right, Jonathan, I think I pass these back to you.
So this is the final slide of the presentation. Thank you, Megan, for taking us through the mechanics. So the next risk policy working group meeting is going to be on March 9th. We are planning to consider the further refinements to the 5 factors, recommended factors that we talked about today. So then getting a little more in the weeds around recruitment, commercial and recreational fishery characterization. We'll be considering some recommended changes about the risk policy mechanics, although I think given the focus of that could happen before or after the April meeting. And I think we're just on internally, we're really thinking about how do we gather the information? How do we set up guidance for plan teams to complete the scoring? And so that's what that third sub-bullet is all about. We'll check in with the SSC and council. We're going to start revising the risk policy concept document, and we look forward to bringing you an update in April. Thanks.
Thank you, Jonathan, Megan. Really great stuff. Very up to date. Obviously, we just had our risk policy meeting last week, so I think this is where we are at this point. I will open it up to questions on the presentation. I'll go to Mr. Pappalardo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for the presentation, Megan, Jonathan. With respect to the scaling question that was at the tail end of that presentation, are there certain conditions or situations where it may be advisable to have a tighter gradient of access to the curve?
I can try and take this, Jonathan. You know, we haven't specifically talked about that, John, but I would just note, you know, your probability of being at the extremes is probably less, right? Like, we're going to be naturally concentrated in a certain portion of the curve. I think what we're trying to make sure is it is just possible to get the full range of scores. It doesn't mean that that's always likely. Is there a situation you're thinking of where it would be advisable to not be accessing a certain portion of the curve?
I haven't gotten that far in my thinking, but just seemed not at this time, but I'll try to participate in the next meeting and put some thought into it prior to that. And then just one last comment. I know we're focused on the applying this to the stock level, but can't help but think about applying this type of an approach to a total ecosystem cap removals for an ecosystem. That's my EBFM hat back on my head. So thanks.
Thanks, John. And I get your take on applying it. And I'm sorry, I'm just kind of chiming in here as a risk policy member thinking about that. I get the idea of trying to apply it at the ecosystem level. I think one of the things that we may find is that if we're trying to assess it at an ecosystem level, things may be negating it themselves. Obviously, good stocks would be negating bad stocks, and we would kind of be in the middle of the road, but obviously we would need to see the actual numbers behind it. But that would just be my initial concern if we were thinking about it at the ecosystem level. But I would love to talk further with you about it offline. I'll go next to Mr. Pentney.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. First of all, I mean, this is great. I mean, the presentation was excellent. And I think the work that the risk policy working group has done has been really outstanding. Very, very impressed with the thought and all the factors that have gone into this so far. And I'm really looking forward to utilizing this in the coming months and years. The only thing that really kind of jumped out at me in terms of a question was on the climate vulnerability factor, where you're limiting to only taking, being less risk, to having less risk, depending on how a stock is, may respond to climate change. And I think I kind of understand that if we were only looking at stocks that were either kind of neutral to climate change or potentially vulnerable to climate change, then that makes sense. But I think we have some evidence, that there are certain stocks, and of course for us, Black Sea Bass jumps out as one that seems to be actually doing very, very well in the face of climate change. And so I would think that there are potentially cases where we would want to be able to take more risk on for stocks that, we have confidence are actually going to be doing very, very well in the face of what we're seeing in the climate. So just throwing that out there as either if you've thought about this already and have a response, great. If not, if it's something maybe the group can take another look at, I would encourage that. Thanks.
Thanks, Meg. This is Megan. I appreciate the kind words on this. I think Black sea bass is a great example. We don't manage that right now. So unfortunately, all of the New England species in the original climate vulnerability analysis all are scored as like neutral or not faring well in climate change. So that's why it's adding precaution at this point. But in the new CVA, we can certainly reassess if we want this to be a two-way risk tolerance, or if, you know, our suite of species changes, something like that, then I think that would certainly be a reason to reevaluate. But yeah, I hear you on there can be winners. I think at present, we don't have any under the original CVA framework.
Thanks, Megan. Terry Alexander.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Thanks, Megan and Jonathan. So I sat in on the meeting on Friday and listened, and that was the first one I'd listened to, you know, because the first one you've had, I guess. And you know, I had lots of questions, which I'll ask most of them offline, but it was interesting that Mike touched on the climate vulnerability when, you know, I was looking, we put a new water temperature sensor on my boat. And so it kind of intrigued me that we were doing it, and I've been watching it on the boat. So I reached out to John Hare, and he hooked me up with the guy that was running the EMUL system. And I started looking at, you know, we talk about ocean warming and all that stuff all along. And my take on what I'm seeing on the graphs is bottom temperature has not changed in the last however old the EMUL stuff is. I'm not saying it doesn't change. I'm just saying the observations that they haven't seemed to be pretty consistent over the last 20 years. Or how old that system is. I just wanted to point that out. And the skeptic in me says, okay, if I'm an assessment scientist and I'm looking at the council has made their policy much more flexible. So that means when we're in our assessment groups trying to figure out what data we're using to go into the assessments, we need to be more diligent about what we're using, whether it be which papers we're going to cite, which literature or which tests that have been done all over the world we're going to cite in these species and stuff, and make sure that we take out most of that uncertainty. So when it goes to the council, that number's to the best of our ability, right? But what that doesn't take into consideration for us, for the fleet, I say us, fishermen, is, you know, the total lack of data that the Science Center is working with. And I'll use Whitehake as the example. They aren't seeing the young of the year anymore because we don't do the shrimp survey anymore. And that's why they got most of that information. The Bigelow survey track has changed because of fixed gear. There's a lot of fixed gear in the Gulf of Maine now. And that's nothing but increase over the last 20 years. You know, as we're looking at this, I think the council should have its eyes open to those assessments coming out of the center nowadays are worst case scenario every time because they don't have the data that they used to have. They're not,
Terry.
They don't have the same information. So, is there something in here that lets us do that, Megan? If you know what I mean?
There was a lot going on in that commentary.
I know. I had to explain it. I'm sorry.
I think there's maybe two parts here. I think some of it might be in the assessment factor, which I don't think we're not going to have ready for June, but certainly we heard on the call Friday a real interest from folks to continue to prioritize the inclusion of that type of uncertainty from assessments or missing data or whatever it is. So I think that's like one avenue to address what you're talking about. And then I think the other could be the AP question in the commercial fishery factor. That's, I would say, less about the assessment, but it could be an opportunity to bring some of the observations from the fishermen into the risk policy. I'll turn to Jonathan if he has any other thoughts on that.
Thanks, Megan. Thanks, Terry. That's kind of where my mind was going. I think the working group has put emphasis on how we can think about using information that's been gathered since the most recent stock assessment, if we're in a place where we're getting assessments in a five-year interval. So I think that's an area to continue to focus on. And I would agree with Megan that I think a lot of the comments about in the first part of your statement should really be addressed through the assessment process in terms of reference and that sort of thing. I don't think there's a real mechanism right now in the risk policy to handle all of what you brought up, but I think there's some things that we can focus on.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Terry. Up next, Mr. Pierdnock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Megan and Jonathan, for your presentation. Slide 22 notes relationship to risk and socioeconomic stress increases, risk tolerance increases. I just have some questions about this socioeconomic details. What economics does that specifically look at? Because I'll note, for instance, there's a fishery economics of the U.S. dated 2022 from NOAA that includes recreational and commercial details of such economics. And recreationally, it shows the job, sales, and income and value added associated with the recreational fishery. And it also breaks it into the for-hire private mode shoreside and durable equipment purchases, which for New England is $584 million of U.S. recreational expenditures or revenue. So the difficulty of that is it's a little different than the way the commercial fleet looks at the economics. So I'm curious of what, when the socioeconomic is looked at, are they looking at the jobs, the sales, the income, the value added, as well as the different modes and durable equipment purchases in order to make a decision? What is the source and the extent of the details in order to make that decision?
Morning, Mike. So I think right now we're focused on fleet diversity, which is looking at, you know, shore versus private versus for hire. Index of that in the state of the ecosystem report. And then we're looking at number of angler trips. So I think you're maybe fairly asking a question about, is it more like social as opposed to socioeconomic that we're looking at? I think the other element that maybe we should be adding to our risk description is data uncertainty in the recreational fishery, because that's what 3 and 4 are kind of getting at. But right now we're not including things like a recreational multiplier effect in the economy or things like that. I think we've been trying to focus on data sources that are fairly recent. I don't know what if the 2022 report you're referencing, if that's like the most recent run. I think they do that every year, but my recollection is sometimes there's a lag in when we get those, but you probably know better than me.
Thank you, Megan. I just asked that we take a second look to make sure that we're looking at the blue economy impacts of the decisions, tackle sales and everything else associated with it, because it is significant, and to not have that in there may not adequately weight the impact. But, you know, this is an initial screening And we can't make it do everything that possibly we could do with a further evaluation. But if that could be further looked at, as I'm concerned from yesterday's presentation as well as today, I want to make sure that recreational fisheries adequately weighted, and with the way it's looked at commercially versus recreational, there's different ways to look at that and skin the cat. So I just want to make sure that it's fair and equitable in the end to have both be looked at appropriately. The last thing is, and I'm glad you clarified the fleet diversity is different modes. The PSEs, we talked about it yesterday. I mean, you can take the total PSEs, average them out, and get them to 30. But if you look at each mode, each state, each species, it's very telling where the problems are and what needs to be addressed. But I may be asking to try to do something more than what is the objective of this. That's my only comments. Thank you.
Thanks for those comments. And Mike, and this is me again, just kind of from a risk policy standpoint, not as chair, just kind of want to point out that I think when we think about recreational factor and even the commercial factor and risk policy as whole is that we're applying it to the stocks that we manage. And that's the mechanism that we're trying. And don't get me wrong, I think looking at things like by state, by mode, by season, by wave, whatever it is. But that's not actually how we manage or make recommendations on. So I think that's why we're taking more of a higher level overview. I believe, you know, we could talk about this more offline as we roll up to the June time period. And I think that was one of the intentions from the risk policy folks is to kind of circle back with our recreational folks, whether it's you, Peter, and Andy, just to make sure that we're particularly on track, because obviously we don't have a recreational representative on our risk policy.
I have one last thing.
Sure, go ahead.
No, thank you. You know, I actually like the slide 20 for the commercial fishery with the different factors, quota usage, and that's where fishing community and value, where that's looked at a little differently commercially. And that's why I point out these other mechanisms here to look at value and the blue economy impacts and the total cost of that, which 2 and 3 is a little different recreationally. And number 4, we talked about it yesterday. You fish for haddock and avoid cod. So there's limiting factors with number 4 that are impacting recreationally. So some of these things are noted here, yet they're not noted recreationally. I just wanted to point it out, and I'd be happy to continue the discussion. And I'm disappointed there is no recreational representation on the work group. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. And yeah, like I said, I think the risk policy, at least Jonathan, Megan, and I did want to kind of reach out to our recreational folks to make sure we were capturing what they thought potentially would be. Any further questions on risk policy? Seeing none. Do you have anything else
Mr.
for us?
Chair?
Sorry. Is that Scott? Scott Oshevsky?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I'm having trouble with my hand. I just had a quick, I guess, comment, question. And this always comes up when I think about sort of how we manage skate as a complex, and then kind of, you know, a future project to join an FMP between two species, and kind of how this risk policy might apply. Are we thinking that it would apply sort of at the species level, and sort of how would those two things be joined at some point, I guess? And I guess I don't need an answer right away. It's just something I think about, obviously. So thanks.
Morning, Scott. Yeah, so I actually think skates is the hardest one because we have, I believe, individual stock assessments, but all of our like commercial fishery information is aggregated to the multi-species fishery level. So I think at this point for a skates, you know, we could look at individual species assessments, but the commercial fishery factor for each species would be the same because it's based on that aggregate data. I think maybe what you're asking is like, what if skates and monkfish were combined in an FMP? I'd have to think more about that. We can think about that.
Okay, Thank you.
Give you another bite at the apple here, Terry.
Yeah, just a quick one, Dan, if you would, please.
Sure, please.
All right, thanks. Jonathan or Megan, I don't know which one, but so have we looked at maybe testing, you know, what the new risk policy would look like against the existing risk policy that we have now? Like, say somebody such as myself with a suite of permits and say, okay, if Terry had this on this in 2010, during that risk policy, if we changed it to this one, how would it look for him? Have you thought about doing something like that?
This is Megan. I may ask for a little help, Jonathan. I think some of the simulation work in the IRA One project that UMaine is doing is comparing the old risk policy versus this new risk policy in terms of what the control rules would be and the outputs of that. Do I have that right, Jonathan?
So I do think that's part of that conversation is what does it look like moving away from our current harvest control rules? I think, Terry, what you're asking is probably not something that you could really compare with what the council's already approved with the new risk policy. And what I mean by that is that the old formulation kind of envisioned management strategy evaluations or a very qualitative approach that could be applied by the council and the SSC, and that's not really where we've moved to. And so, you know, I think what we're planning to bring in April is a full example of scoring of the factors, weightings, Z-scores, all the way through harvest control rule to give people a number. What is your ABC? What's your ACL when you use the new risk policy in a potentially a revised harvest control rule? I think at that point, you could just compare the old harvest control rule with what you're getting now. So the former risk policy didn't really align with and work with harvest control rules the way we're envisioning this new iteration. And so I think you can still do the comparison, but you can't mix and match them.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, thanks. I'm just curious. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry. Seeing no more questions or comments from our council members, I will go out to the public. If there's any questions, Megan Lapp.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Cool. Megan Lapp, Seafreeze. I just have a question on this because I'm the chair of the Herring Advisory Panel. And in the Herring FMP, I know that this has like been discussed a little bit with regards to this risk policy update before, but in the Herring FMP, we have a hockey stick ABC control rule that is codified in the FMP. So if this were to go in, like, what's the controlling thing? Like, what are we going to use to actually set harvest levels? This, which is a little bit higher level, but it's still using, you know, a graph, a pinpoint on a graph, or the harvest control rule that actually is in the FMP.
Dr. O'Keefe? Oh.
Thanks for the question, Megan. what we're trying to consider is applying the new risk policy and possibly revising our ABC control rules across our plans to try to reach some consistency. We're unique in among councils in the idea that we developed ABC control rules for each one of our FMPs separately compared to an overarching kind of council policy around risk, which would inform an overarching type of control rule. So right now, Herring is not the only FMP that has the harvest control rule baked into the regulations. Some of our plans have that, some of them do not. So we're moving towards some consistency, and how we do that, each plan by plan, will depend on the type of action that we're working on at the time and the way that the control rule is revised. I would say that Herring was identified by the risk policy working group early on, that as it had gone through a full management strategy evaluation to develop the control rule, that we wouldn't be trying to change Herring as the first example of the new risk policy. So we're starting with trying to revise the groundfish control rule, and we would be having a lot of discussions around applications to herring in the coming years if that's the direction that we decide to go in. Thanks.
Up next, I see Mike Wayne. We'll get you unmuted. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike Wayne, the American Sport Fishing Association. I thought this was a great presentation, laying it out. I've seen sort of the progression over time. So thanks for that. But I, you know, when we worked on the recreational harvest control rule and the measure setting process for summer flounder scup and black sea bass, one thing that we learned is when we started implementing the harvest control rule, there were some things that popped up that we didn't expect. And so I guess my question is relevant to the risk policy. Like, what is the mechanism that would be in place to try to make adjustments on the fly as we, as the council begins to implement this, they will likely learn about how it impacts our management through the implementation of this risk policy. And so I was just curious how future iterations will occur based on kind of what is learned in the iteration. And then will there be some examples that we can see on how this would be implemented, or is it just going to be approval and straight into implementation?
I'll go to Jonathan.
Hey, good morning, Mike. Thanks for the question. I think it's a good one. It's an important one. We tried to get at it a little bit at the tail end of Friday's meeting. I think what you can expect, what the council should expect to see before June, and is implementation. What does the risk policy look like when it's combined with a harvest control rule? And I think we can start to have some of those conversations about what the output looks like and what people expected at that time. I think there is a desire among working group members that the risk policy doesn't become static and sit on the shelf, that there will be opportunity for iteration to see what's working well over time. I think we've always felt like we need to learn by doing. And so I would expect that by the end of this calendar year, after we've had the opportunity to go through the process, have the SSC meet and deliberations, that we would come back and see what went well, where we could make improvements, and that there'll be opportunity. I'm not sure how frequently, but certainly close to an annual basis. Thanks.
Thank you, Jonathan. Up next, I have Jason Didden.
Hi there, thanks. I was just thinking about some of the questions of linking to your all's old risk policy, and if there are any plans in some of the simulation work to compare the output of the new risk policy and control rule to the MIDS. I know there may be some IRA overlapping projects that are planned, that just wasn't sure, but I think it could be useful from either council's perspective of kind of the differences in, since ours is kind of a quantitative, relatively simple rollout, it might be a relatively easy comparison. It may already be on the table, but just throwing it out there as an idea. Thanks.
Jonathan?
Yeah, Jason, thanks for that comment. I get question comment. I think it's an interesting idea. When we were in the early stages of development of the risk policy, we did invite a presentation from Brandon Muffley on your staff. I think we had a lot to learn from how the Mid-Atlantic has approached this question. I know you all have updated a little more frequently than we have in New England. So, you know, I think this question of like how they both operate is one that we'll want to watch. I think the short term focus is really going to be how can we get the New England one working with a harvest control rule, and then maybe a next step would be to think about some of the points that you raised, because we're really, without the risk policy being baked into harvest control rules, I think our the short term need is to try to button this up for June, and then we could think about that a little more long term.
Thank you, Jonathan. One last call to the public on questions on the presentation for risk policy. Seeing none, back to the council. Any quick follow-ups? Quick, if there are any. Seeing none. Thank you very much, Jonathan, Megan, to the Risk Policy Working Group. You guys are doing a great job. Obviously, we have at least one more meeting scheduled in March to kind of start buttoning up the few things that we said we wanted to button up. But we are looking for implementation of this component in at the June council meeting. So we are moving forward. We would like to make sure that this is ready to go in June. So thank you very much, Risk Policy folks.